This is The Human
and the Machine,
brought to you by Editorial Intelligence in association with Vodafone.
Welcome to The Human and the Machine. I'm Julia Hobsbawm.
And I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, we'll be looking at...
It turns out that in the modern world, you can work without air conditioning and you can work without sewage, but you literally cannot work without the internet.
And we'll be discussing...
We could build a system in which you can sign up, you can create an avatar, you can train that avatar, and that avatar can start voting on the things that the Congress in your country is voting on, and you can see what that avatar is doing without having to make that decision binding or politically powerful.
As well as our regular features on the best and worst of tech.
I cannot read a book with my phone in the room. I actually cannot do it. So I now have to turn my phone off and put it in a separate room.
That's all ahead right here on The Human and the Machine. Stay with us.
Hello and welcome. Now, Julia, you have just returned from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where you were visiting the Media Lab. Very exciting stuff.
I've had the most wonderful time in arguably the cradle of connectedness, the 150-year-old research university, mainly in engineering and the physical sciences. But MIT is world-renowned, and the Media Lab, which is 30 years old, has really followed and created everything from wearable tech and cognition learning to two subjects we're going to hear about today. Social physics, what is that, you ask? And AI democracy, you might ask what that is too.
I certainly will be asking that, and I know that we'll be getting the answers when we hear those discussions a little bit later. First, though, there's nothing more frustrating than falling offline. So in this next discussion, we find out how that can be avoided. This is The Human
and the Machine.
So we're going to have a very technical discussion in the studio today. In fact, we're going to have a prop tech discussion. I'm joined by William Newton and Tom Redmayne. William is the president and EMEA MD at WiredScore, and Tom is the director of business development in the UK and Ireland at WiredScore. What is WiredScore? WiredScore wires commercial buildings to make them fully connected. So hello to William and hello to Tom.
Hello.
Hello.
So what is prop tech, William?
Well, prop tech is a phrase that popped up about 3 years ago to try to explain the rise of technology within the property industry, specifically the commercial real estate industry. Commercial real estate has for a long time been a pretty slow industry that's tried to do things in a very similar way to the way it's done in the past. But there's been a huge movement to try and change the way that the entire industry runs. I think it's particularly drawing its inspiration from fintech. It's looking at how finance has really tried to reinvigorate itself and apply new approaches to old problems, and PropTech's trying to do the same thing.
You look after, I think, something like probably getting on for 1,500 properties and 400 million square feet around the world. Is that right? Europe, but also America?
Yeah, so we started in New York originally, and subsequently the UK and Ireland, and hopefully pushing on there in the next 18 to 24 months to other countries as well.
Are the challenges that WiredScore is addressing a sort of microcosm of wider society, i.e., you know, I've just been out into the wilds of mid Wales where, I mean, there's no mobile reception where I am and broadband is patchy. I mean, are they the same issues magnified? You have a commercial property and you either do or don't have good broadband connection, or is there something else at play?
Digital connectivity is a little bit different in an office environment from in a home environment. For most people at home, the big thing that they're struggling with is, can they get the speed that they actually need to be able to stream Netflix or do whatever they want? But in a commercial environment, you face a very different set of factors. The three things that we always say that we're trying to reflect, which are the lived experience of the businesses that occupy space, are one, how quickly can they get the internet set up and running? Are they going to spend ages working on 4G dongles because they can't actually bring the fiber into their building quickly enough? Two, are they going to pay the right price for the kind of speed that they want? If you've got lots of different internet providers coming into the building, you're likely to pay a much lower speed. And then the really big one is three, which is, how likely is it that your internet's going to go down? For most businesses, the idea of having their internet go down, even if it's only for an hour, can be absolutely devastating. I think probably the best way to illustrate how important this can be is to tell a story from a couple of years ago in Manhattan, with a large famous landlord who we hadn't yet started working with, and a famous co-working space. And the co-working space was moving into the building and had a nightmare first month. So in their first week, the air conditioning went down, which was deeply unpleasant in a sticky New York summer, but basically fine, and everyone stayed at their desks and kept on working. And then in the second week, the sewage went down, which was truly disgusting, and everyone wanted to avoid the loos, but they basically stayed at their desks and kept on working. And then, fortunately, in the third week, nothing went wrong, but in the fourth week, someone cut through the one comms entry chamber into the building, so literally severed all the fiber optic cables coming into the building. And as soon as the internet went down, every single person in the co-working space stood up and left and went and worked in the bars and the cafes around Manhattan. Because it turns out that in the modern world, you can work without air conditioning and you can work without sewage, but you literally cannot work without the internet.
Although I'm going to challenge you slightly on that, in that there's the fantastic case study of Sony, which actually I wrote about in my book, Fully Connected, and which our resident tech historian Charles Arthur has written about in his new book, Cyber Wars. You're right, William, but also the reality is humans do regroup and recalibrate their options. But the fact is, it's very expensive for business, isn't it? So in the case of Sony, Tom, what happened is there was a hack that took out literally every single document and every single connection for weeks. But Sony's profits for Sony Pictures Entertainment, which was the bit of the business that was affected, in fact showed a relatively marginal dip. So I'm not trying to say we don't need permanent connectivity, but it is in the end as much for convenience as it is for productivity, is it?
Yeah, and that's also an amazing example of when a business has all come together in adversity and really worked incredibly hard to get around a problem, and you require a fantastic team to do that. I think connectivity enables us to have a much broader reach with our work, but also within our social lives. I moved into a house last year that had no phone signal at all, which was a nightmare. But actually, it hasn't affected me in the slightest, because my TV runs through the internet, and my phone calls run through the internet. And actually, it's become ubiquitous in every sense of the way in which I live, work and play.
So the internet is, in a sense, the main artery through which we all live and connect. And your strapline is connectivity matters. You're, I guess, Tom, effectively the chief salesperson, the business development guy for WiredScore. Does anybody ever say to you, that's not our number one priority?
Not often, no.
Right.
I think no one disagrees with the fact that the internet's important, and it's only going to become more important to businesses in the years to come. A lot of what we do as a business is you have the real estate industry and the telecoms and engineering industry that are intrinsically linked, but very rarely talk to each other. A lot of what we do is translate quite complicated telecoms and engineering into a language that real estate and occupiers and people working in offices can really understand, so they know how they can actually go about improving it. Because there's so much inefficiency in the information out there, actually allowing people to understand what their options are and how they should think about improving people.
So that really interests me and even excites me, because what I think is a shift, which is welcome, and I think WiredScore is an example of it, is a much more homogenous way of joining up the way technology works with humans. I mean, William, there's a kind of values system underpinning all of this, isn't it? Which is, it's not just cables over there doing their thing. It's an integration with the people who are installing and managing them.
Yeah, exactly. As Tom says, you know, we're trying to bring together groups of people who don't normally talk to each other. And we're not trying to do that because we really like nice cable runs. We're trying to do it because what underlies all of this is letting humans do what they want to do. And so everything that we try to reflect is about an individual sitting at their desk, trying to be as productive as they can and having as many choices as they can. And if real estate businesses and telecoms businesses think about that person more than anything else, they're going to produce something which people love.
I mean, hundreds of years ago, I ran a tiny little PR agency in the middle of Soho, London, where BT, for years, were digging up the pavement and putting in something. And it just meant weeks of disruption. And we could never even approach a direct line manager. We could never get an answer. We felt we were in a sort of primordial soup of miscommunication. How do you address that fact? I mean, okay, WiredScore goes in, gets a ton of money, puts in all the cabling and the fibre optics and the broadband. What happens when something does not work? Who do they ring at WiredScore? Do they ring you, Tom, and complain?
Thankfully not. So we don't actually put in the systems in place. So what we do is we help landlords understand what they have existing in their buildings and how they could improve that. And then give them a rating as well. But a lot of it is about...
So you give them a certificate, don't you?
We give them a certificate, but we also enable them to see what's wrong with their buildings and really outline how they can improve that. So we don't cost or do the works themselves, but we work very closely to help them advise how they should be thinking about that. We can often introduce them to people that can help them, but if we were doing the works ourselves and then giving them a better rating, that's a little bit close to them.
So it's sort of a kite mark, is it? That you're basically saying this building has been certified by WiredScore, therefore if you are a business that needs constant connectivity, what business doesn't?
Yeah, so there are really three reasons that people work with us. And firstly, our clients are landlords, but our users are tenants and occupiers and businesses.
Right.
So some landlords use us as a way to market their space to tenants, to show them that they have the great connectivity and that they should come to that building. Other landlords really use us from an obsolescence perspective. They have older buildings, they're worried about the connectivity within them, and they want to make sure that they're being proactive rather than reactive and be able to provide the kind of environments that businesses want to work in. And then thirdly, on new developments and new buildings, really from the ground upwards, ensuring that these buildings are going to be inherently relevant, flexible and aspirational, not just for now, but also for the business needs for 5, 10, 15 years down the line. And that's things like 5G and the technologies that have come through, and how do you put in place that infrastructure that will enable businesses to keep working?
So I've got another technical question before I want to move on to close with cyber wars. And my technical question is this: lifts. I just was in New York. It seems to me a very scary technological development when you get in a lift and you can't even press the button because it's been pre-programmed. Are you anything to do with that terrible trend, William? I'm looking at you. Do you know the one I mean?
I do, and I can promise that we're not to blame. I once spent about a month living in a hotel in Johannesburg for work, which for security reasons, the front desk had to program the floor that you went onto after you got in. And the loss of autonomy I found really scary. You were completely in the hands of somebody else and you had no control when you were inside. I think that's a scary feature and I'm worried about it.
I mean, I think it is a scary feature. And is this not in a way the contract that we are all making with technology? We have to give more control than really is ideal in order to get the maximum benefit and safety. But what happens when that control is misused or malfunctions?
Cambridge Analytica and Facebook has finally brought to the surface the pact that we've all been implicitly making that nobody really understood. People didn't know they were giving away this level of data control. And the more that people find out about it, the less comfortable they are.
We should say, because we don't know when people will be listening to this, and hopefully they'll be listening to it for years and years to come, we're recording this particular edition in London in April 2018. Within a month-long period, as you say, the lid has been lifted on the privacy pact that has been made between millions and millions and millions of people on social media. And just yesterday, JD Weatherspoons, a massive pub chain with over $1 billion in turnover and something like 56 million in net profits and 35,000 employees, has decided to come completely off social media. So there's a sort of connectivity backlash happening as well, isn't there?
I think the question from the Weatherspoon's perspective is whether or not they're getting value for money out of actually being on social media. What they're trying to point out is that we don't all need to follow exactly the same marketing techniques as one another.
Yeah.
And just because all of our competitors have suddenly decided that they need to have a constant conversation with their customers on social media doesn't mean that we all need to. I don't think any people are going to Weatherspoons because of the engaging and witty banter on their Twitter feed. I think they're going there because they think it's a nice place to have a pint.
Tim Martin, the founder, said that 90 to 95% of his customers, i.e. his pub landlords, said it made no discernible difference on footfall into the pubs. But this brings me sort of circling back to this question about constant connectivity, which it seems to me that we have all in some shape or form, whether we're social media consumers, whether we're businesses, have drunk some mass Kool-Aid that's been coming out of, let's call it Silicon Valley, for 25 years that says constant connectivity is the way to be. It isn't, is it?
No, I don't think it is at all. And to kind of put it into a real estate context, I often get asked, what's a smart building? What do you define as a smart building? And I don't think a smart building is the building with the most amount of technology technology in it possible. I think a smart building is a building that serves its users in the way that they want it to. And I think that's a combination of wellness. I think that's a combination of good technology, but not technology for technology's sake, and giving people the environment that is flexible enough to give them what they want out of their job and how it links into their home life as well.
Final point is really about cyber wars and about planned outages and interventions. Even though that's not what you do, you make buildings ready and certificated for connectedness. How much of an issue is that? You must go to conferences, you must have discussions. William, how, and you've also worked yourself in policy making before coming to WiredScore, how much of an issue is cyber politics?
Cyber politics and cyber crime are going to be one of the great sort of three or four topics of the next 50 years. It's going to be where we're all focused and concerned about our security, both individual and personal, but also collective and societal. And cybercrime and cyber terrorism can pose an existential threat to our countries. Fortunately, I think policymakers are aware of this. Interestingly, I'd say they're much, much more aware of this than the private sector. I think the private sector is taking a long while to really catch up in a meaningful way and understand the implications of how dangerous cybercrime can be to not just their businesses, but to their consumers.
And do you think partly that's for businesses that are scaling up quickly, putting in place the security structures as they grow? It's very difficult to keep that over time.
Well, I think you have the two-pronged concern of small companies like us scaling and having to build things as we go, but also larger companies who don't feel like they, as the senior management, have a real grip on what's going on in cybercrime, and so haven't been paying sufficient attention to it. And we don't yet have enough experts to really help us develop the ecosystem to protect ourselves against possible threats, Russian or otherwise.
So thank you, Tom and William. That is Tom Redmayne and William Newton of WiredScore for being with us today. And I know that you'll be back in a future programme.
This is The Human and the Machine.
The Human and Machine curates pop-up symposiums and salons and discussions for corporates who want to bring their workforces together to talk about what all of this technology means. If you'd like us to do one for you, go to thehumanandmachine.com.
One of our favourite features in this programme is Techno Heaven and Techno Hell, the best and worst of the digital world. Let's hear a sample.
I'm Herminia Ibarra, Professor of Organizational Behavior at the London Business School and author of Act Like a Leader, Think Like a Leader. My idea of techno heaven is having someone program Alexa for me to do everything that I need.
My name's Eliza Philby, and I'm a historian of generations. My techno hell is that my son's first words are, "Hey Siri."
Hi, I'm Timandra Harkness, author of Big Data, Does Size Matter? And presenter of Sundry Radio Things. I have my techno heaven with me in this tiny bag. It clips onto my swimming goggles and it has earplugs that fit into my ears. It's a waterproof MP3 player. This genuinely is the technology that has changed my life.
Hello, my name is Tracy Groves and I'm the founder and director of Intelligent Ethics. My idea of techno heaven is the fact that I can speak to my mum, my sister and my two nephews face to face over the phone as they live in Spain. So I speak to them every day.
This is The Human
and the Machine,
brought to you by Editorial Intelligence in association with Vodafone.
Julia, we were talking earlier about your trip to Boston and the fact that you went to MIT's Media Lab, and we'll be hearing some of those. Who's first?
We start with Professor Alex Sandy Pentland. He's the director of the MIT Connection Science and Human Dynamics Lab. He's a serial entrepreneur himself, a founding member of advisory boards for Google, Nissan, and indeed the UN Secretary General. And Sandy has really led the way in developing our understanding about actually the human and the machine. So I had to beat a path to his door.
Every Wednesday we have speakers in, often it's speakers from within the group, just to talk about topics in social physics. And today we had one about the economics of all these new tokens and cryptocurrencies and things. And then we had one about how social influence determines what you do.
The cryptocurrency talk was particularly interesting to me because she addressed the question of
Ronald Burt's brokerage enclosure model in networks, this this idea of how we've fundamentally moved from a linear model of relationships in the world and hierarchies to a lateral, asymmetrical network world. Is that right?
No, I'd have to disagree with that. We used to be in that network world up until the beginning of the 1900s, because there were some mathematicians in England who tried to write down the rules of this and discovered that they couldn't deal with networks. So they made it very simple. They made it a bunch of individuals that were similar. And that's where we get the rational individual model. And so it's this sort of simplification of reality down to something that they could deal with mathematically. And unfortunately, it's sort of flattering to be called rational and in charge of yourself. And so it's really taken off. And it's the way policymakers, business people, everybody thinks about humans. But of course, humans are really elements of a network. It's the social fabric that matters. In fact, if you go back to people like Adam Smith, that's what he was saying. He wasn't saying about rational individuals. And I think what's really interesting is if you look what Adam Smith said about it and what Karl Marx said about it, they're really very same. They're talking about how people are the sum of their social relationships. So at least up through Karl Marx, that's what people generally believed. And it was only with a sort of rise of markets and some of these simplified models that I think people lost sight of that.
And yet you sit within MIT, where one of your biggest outputs are spin-off labs, and one of the biggest clients of the spin-off labs are people who want to make money out of predictive data. I mean, is that because the use of your work can both improve society and increase wealth generation? Do you feel in any way anxious or conflicted about the value your data has on big bad capitalists?
This is like a lot of science. You can use it for good or you could use it for evil. And my work has two pieces. One piece is understanding humans better, which, like I say, you can use for marketing, but you could also use to make government better. And then the other thing we do is we build architectures for preserving privacy, for increasing safety of data, and things like that. And the two of those together offer the promise of a lot more transparency and accountability and effectiveness in government. If you get the regulation part right, it means that companies can do a better job at delivering what people want without abusing them.
How well do you think governments to date, at large, has made use of technology and its possibilities in policymaking?
When it comes to things like policymaking and sort of understanding things, they're very poor, I would say. So they have built systems to be able to do simulations, but the simulations are based on overly simple assumptions or guesswork in many cases, and treated like the truth. So as a result, you get consistent underestimate of some effects and overestimation of other effects. What we really need to do is we need to understand ourselves, our human society, better in order to do better predictive modeling. If you can do better predictive modeling, you can make policies that really begin to work.
Is that why you've created the Human Dynamics Lab to map social networks and to move away from what you've wonderfully called the digital breadcrumbs approach to something more systemic, that we really can understand behaviors and improve the lot of large numbers of people if we use the data correctly?
There's two things. One is that you need data, and we're beginning to see data in all sorts of things, from cell phones, from credit cards, from transportation. You need to handle that correctly to preserve privacy, to be safe. But it also gives you this wonderful viewpoint into how society really works, so that we can come to a much better understanding of who we are and how we should organize society.
One of the things that interests me about your argument is that you're against what you call self-sovereignty. You are much more in favor of a collective approach. And you even talk about involving the 100 million strong credit unions in rewriting the contract that we have with our digital identity. And you've written this in the Wall Street Journal. So yeah, there's a real change happening.
It used to be centuries ago that it was your community that endorsed you. And it was your reputation in the community that enforced you behaving correctly, because you didn't want to squander that. And as things got bigger and were more anonymous and now more digital, that sort of began to be in tatters and were just these sort of faceless actors. And that's the way a lot of systems treat us. So really, what you want to do is you want your identity to be grounded in your community, the people you care about, the people that care about you, and that they can endorse you, they underwrite you, they're the source of trust. And that's the human way. And all these other systems have to follow the human way, not us adopt their methods, which are overly simplistic or just for convenience.
I'm interested that you are interested in culture, and your connection science lab seems to me predicated on the idea of cultural intelligence through tech. Tell me a bit more about that.
The notion of cultural intelligence is more understanding about your culture and how it works, who we really are, what is the nature of trust, what is the nature of improving yourself so that you can do better, things like that. It's also a question of inventing technology that supports our creation of culture. So the vision is that we as communities decide how to act, and it's a community decision, not an individual decision. And that's sort of this notion of your identity being grounded in community, is that it's relative to a community. You get to choose the community, but when you're in the community, it's all of you together.
Is that because you're an academic, Sandy? Academia is such a collective endeavor at its best, isn't it?
Academia is actually an okay example of that. The classic example is the sort of rural village or the neighborhood where everybody knows each other. And it's a measure of the poverty of our society that we've gotten away from neighborhoods where everybody knows each other and can support each other. So one of the things that's built into our DNA is that sort of structure for trust, for figuring out what the right way to do things are, for getting ahead in the world. And we need to restore that. And so that's the idea of having digital identities, digital properties grounded in community. I'm here to fight for that.
And that was Sandy Pentland of MIT.
And we have more to come from MIT in just a moment.
And now for Techno Shabbat.
Pretty much every human and every machine drives and thrives on connection. But sometimes you just need to switch off. Here's what our guests think of Techno Shabbat.
My name is Dolly Alderton. I'm a journalist, a podcaster, and author of Everything I Know About Love. And my Techno Shabbat is that because I'm a millennial and my brain has been ruined for life by technology, I cannot read a book with my phone in the room. I actually cannot do it. So I now have to turn my phone off and put it in a separate room if I'm reading a book.
Hi, my name's Hannah Such, and I'm a co-founder of the walking app Go Jauntly. And my techno Shabbat is very difficult, and I walk. Funnily enough, I get really bad motion sickness as well. So if I'm on a train or a bus, I can't use my phone because I feel physically sick. So if I'm walking or I'm out and about, I don't look at my phone.
My name is Tom Adeyula, CEO and founder of Meetail, and my techno Shabbat are my kids. So I think it's my children that help to bring me back to the present, and I'm extremely grateful to them for that.
This is the human
and the machine.
It's time now for us to return to MIT.
So I had the great fortune when I was at the MIT Media Lab in spotting through the door of his office César Ildego, a man whose work I've much admired, as well as Sandy Pentland's. César leads the collective learning group at MIT Media Lab. He's a statistical physicist and a data visualization designer, but he's just begun to work on some really quite startling and exciting ideas about AI and no less than democracy itself.
So at the moment, I'm working on a couple of things, one of which I think might be interesting for the audience of this podcast, which is how we can use software agents to augment democracy and think of implementing democracy in a different way.
You come from Latin America. You are very interested in your work again and again in how you can democratize through data. But aren't we seeing the opposite effect at the moment? Aren't we seeing a nervousness that data used at scale is undermining democracy?
Of course, because in some way, the data that is being collected and is being used in elections is being used under false pretenses. Nobody went to Facebook to try to do an act of civic participation. And those false pretenses are what erodes the trust on people. I do think that it is possible to use data and artificial intelligence to create better democratic institutions, but not the way that we're doing it right now, in which we're telling people that they're doing something and eventually we're using their data for something else.
I mean, I'd like you to explain that to me. I know there was a project you did last year, for example, on how data can help make safer neighborhoods, but I'd be lying if I told you I understood why.
Yeah, so maybe that would be a little bit of a deviation of the topic, because it's a very narrow project on trying to evaluate the aesthetics of urban environments using computer vision and machine learning. What I'm talking about now is more of the creation of systems in which you can move from a representative democracy in which you provide your voting power to a person in Congress to represent you to a form of democracy in which you would provide that voting power to an avatar that actually has been programmed and designed to only represent you. And every one of us would have that. So think of a world in which we're implementing democracy differently, not by representation or by a direct action like some people in direct democracy advocate, and it's not possible because of the number of decisions that we have to make, but in a world in which we're augmented by a software agent that can then represent us. So we have a Congress that has as many people as we have citizens, but each one of those people in Congress are actually robots that are there to represent our nuanced interests, not an aggregate trade-off of interests.
So does that mean on an ongoing basis you want a congressman or woman sitting in their ivory tower making a decision, but your avatar or robot is making an immediate corrective on their behavior?
So imagine that you don't have politicians, that you've automated them and you've brought them to scale. So think of the House of Representatives of the United States. In the 114th U.S. Congress, they consider 6,500 bills. That's 9 bills a day. So if you wanted to have direct democracy, if you wanted people to participate directly, you cannot do it. 9 bills a day is a lot of work. If you wanted to have professional politicians deal with that, still 9 bills a day is a lot of work. But if you have a software agent that can read the bills and try to predict how you would vote based on your preferences, then you can get to that scale. So what I'm trying to say here is that there might be a future in which we can save the idea of democracy by finding ways of implementing it at a scale that is as large as the one that countries are right now.
Where is this being piloted outside of your lab?
This does not exist yet, but I presented this idea at TED a few weeks ago and I'm starting to bring it to the world. Of course, my idea is not to come out and replace governments as they are today by software agent systems or augmented democracy systems, as I like to call them. My idea is to first start doing experiments. We could build a system in which you can sign up, you can create an avatar, you can train that avatar, and that avatar can start voting on the things that the Congress in your country is voting on, and you can see what that avatar is doing without having to make that decision binding or politically powerful. So we can first start experimenting and building these systems in a grassroots manner. You can think that this could be grad school experiments in which people start exploring the idea of augmented democracy to figure out how it works, to figure out how to build the machine learning algorithms that will be able to interpret law and predict your choices.
The whole premise of this podcast, The Human and the Machine, is that in the end, the human is ultimately better than the machine. But you're almost convincing me that machines can, in fact, improve on the one kind of human that none of us does have much faith in, and that's the political human, right?
It can be put that way. I do think that what's always better is the human and the machine. So people tend to think of the machine only because the machine sometimes might be the one that is making the decision. But that decision is going to be trained on human data and it's going to be under the scrutiny of humans. So the way that I see this, the idea of augmented democracy is not an idea of automation and replacement, but it's an idea of augmentation, like the idea of the bicycle. You can go faster and further and quicker in a bicycle than you can do it walking. Well, you can have a better user interface to democracy if you have an assistant that is a software agent that helps you read all of the things that your government publishes and that tries to understand how your views align with each one of those political issues. So by assisting you, I'm augmenting you. I'm not replacing you. I want you to still be the person that is in charge of that politician, but I want a politician that is obedient to you. And robots are kind of obedient.
If you want to hear more about the work of either Sandy Pentland or César Hidalgo, it's absolutely worth your visiting and rootling around on the website for MIT Media Lab. It's www.media.mit.eu.
This is The Human
and the Machine,
brought to you by Editorial Intelligence in association with Vodafone.
That's it for this edition of The Human and the Machine. If you'd like to know more about anything discussed, head to our website, thehumanandmachine.com.
This show is brought to you by Editorial Intelligence and supported by Vodafone. It was recorded at Spiritland in London's King's Cross. The researcher is Alice Fielden. The studio producer is George McDonough. The executive producer is Julia Hobsbawm. And I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.